Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. A state prison designed to treat those with serious mental illness has repeatedly failed to prevent or respond to fires, even after two people died. The results of an investigation coming up. Also, the state plans to close programs at a Southern Illinois Mental Health and Developmental Center. The move will result in a loss of dozens of jobs. Healthcare costs have skyrocketed for farmers, and it's coming at an especially tough time financially for agriculture. We'll talk with an author as part of our Illinois 250 series in partnership with Illinois Humanities. She reflects on reconnecting with her Native American heritage. And we hear how teachers are responding to the film The Odyssey and how it may help spur interest in the story among students. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A warning, this next story contains descriptions of self-harm. The Joliet Treatment Center is a specialized Illinois prison meant to provide extensive mental health care, but some of those incarcerated and civil rights attorneys say the treatment there has been dismal, and men are often left isolated in cells for long stretches, their mental health deteriorating. Desperate, some have chosen to take extreme action to bring attention to their troubles. They've set their locked cells, or even their own bodies, on fire. In the last 3 years, there have been more than 70 fires at the Joliet Treatment Center, including at least a dozen cases of self-immolation. Shannon Heffernan, reporting for WBEZ and the Marshall Project, brings us details on one case.
Around 10 p.m. on a summer night in 2024, smoke wafts down a hallway lined with prison cells. Minutes later, red flames lick the window inside cell A9. Jason Steffens is locked inside. We pieced together what happened using security video footage, 911 dispatch calls, and documents from the prison and fire department. As seen on video, about 10 minutes after the smoke first started, a group of guards walks down the hall. But when they arrive at the door, they do not let Steffens out. Instead, the guards open a food slot and spray a fire extinguisher and pepper spray inside. Then, smoke so thick you can barely see what's happening on camera, they walk away.
Joliet 911, where's your emergency?
We need the fire department here.
A prison employee calls 911 about 20 minutes after smoke first appeared on the security video.
We were able to extinguish it from what I can see.
Is there still smoke, though?
Yes.
Okay. All right, and are you guys, like, evacuating the inmates immediately around there, away from it?
We're still dealing with the situation. I can't answer that.
The fire department arrives within 5 minutes, but precious time has already been wasted, and more is about to be lost. According to a firefighter's report, guards did not immediately tell firefighters Steffens was still in the cell, even though plenty of prison employees would have known. In the video, people meander up and down the hallway before firefighters say they were finally alerted. They open the cell to find Steffens' limp body, his breaths shallow. It's been more than 30 minutes since smoke first appeared. Steffens' airway is charred.
Call for ambulance 6. Male patient unconscious.
Guards handcuff Steffens' unconscious body, and he's loaded into an ambulance. The ambulance drives to the exit, but there, at the prison gate, the delays continue. Guards won't let the ambulance leave until prison employees fill out paperwork and guards are available to accompany Steffens to the hospital. An argument erupts between the fire department and prison employees. According to one guard, a firefighter said, "This man can die while y'all pussyfooting around." A fire department employee keeps calling back to dispatch to let them know the ambulance is stuck.
All right, Joliet, ambulance 7's in between the gates.
About 7 minutes after getting to the gate, they call again. They say they are doing advanced life-saving care, ALS for short, to try and save Steffens. A machine is forcing air into his lungs.
Just so you know that we're still in between gates with an ALS patient.
15 minutes at the gate, a firefighter calls back to dispatch again.
Just so you know, we're still doing ALS care in between the gates.
21 minutes at the gate, they call again.
Just having our record, ambulance 7 is still doing ALS care in between the gates.
26 minutes.
Ambulance 7 is still doing care in between the gates.
Finally, nearly 28 minutes after they arrive at the gate, and over an hour after smoke first appeared, the ambulance is allowed to leave. At last, the prison got guards to accompany Steffens.
gate is open. Ambulance 7 is going to be in Roth and Joe's.
Stephens finally arrived at St. Joseph Hospital near the prison. In the months leading up to the fire, Stephens had repeatedly told staff he was desperate to get a blood transfusion to help with his sickle cell disease and would do anything, including hurting himself, to get help. He repeatedly swallowed glass, but the prison did not give him what he wanted. After the fire, doctors performed a tracheotomy, cutting a hole in Stephens' throat so they could insert a breathing tube. His mom, Yvette Stephens, said doctors told her he was getting better. So 2 weeks after the fire, when she got the news, she didn't believe it.
He didn't make it. Maybe they would have gotten there quick enough. He would have made it. He was my friend. Not only my son, but my best friend.
Stephens died of smoke inhalation at age 38. For years before his death, there were signs the Joliet Treatment Center was unprepared for emergencies like this. There had already been repeated fires. One man needed a skin graft. Another lost his leg. But even after that, the state fire marshal issued a report saying the prison could not provide an evacuation plan. Some alarms at the prison were disconnected and inoperable. On Stephen's wing, guards were unsure if they even worked. And the delays at the gate? The chief of the local fire department, Jeff Carey, said they complained about the problem for years before Stephen's death.
After every time we had a significant delay, somebody would reach out to them and let them know that whatever you fixed didn't work. We need to be able to get in there faster.
Even after Stephen's death, the problems did not stop. Fire officials continued to document problems with alarms, delays, and evacuation plans. The issues that lead men to set the fires also didn't change. Men continued to report a lack of mental health care and say they spent long stretches isolated in their cells. There have been more than 60 fires at the Joliet Treatment Center since Stephen's death, including at least 8 cases of self-immolation and a second death. The state has refused to provide some key documents related to the deaths, and the Marshall Project is now suing to get them. The Illinois Department of Corrections did not answer our questions about the fires, citing pending litigation. For the Marshall Project and WBEZ, I'm Shannon Heffernan.
Lauren Frost produced that piece, part of a collaboration between WBEZ's Prison Cast and the Marshall Project. If you or someone you know is considering self-harm, call or text 988. Supporters gathered this week for a rally in downtown Anna after the state announced it will close programs at the Southern Illinois Shoat Mental Health and Developmental Center. The unions say the closure means the layoffs of nearly 250 employees at the facility. Brian Sapp reports.
Lauren Dillman is a mental health tech 3 overseeing other workers as they care for the residents at Shoat Mental Health and Development Center. She organized a rally Tuesday, drawing attention to the decision by the Illinois Department of Human Services to close the unit that takes care of intellectually and developmentally disabled patients, as well as reducing the number of mental health beds. She and 24 supporters are letting the community know the impacts this closure will have.
Mental health care in this area, they're trying to take it away and send all of our resources up north. Not everybody has ability for transportation that far, families that can get them there.
The IDHS sent employees an email on Thursday telling them the IDD unit would be closed by September 30th. In a statement from IDHS, the move is part of Governor Pritzker's plan for, quote, transformational change within the state's support system for those with intellectual and developmental disabilities. From there, they made their decision because of declining numbers, a move to more community living arrangements, and changing of service delivery. The governor added more context to the move when he addressed the issue at a bill signing on Tuesday.
Well, remember, I know it gets reported differently than this, but remember, the reason there are staff reductions is because we literally have moved the developmentally disabled patients, residents there to better facilities, to other facilities. So at some point, you don't need staffing when there's nobody at that facility. We have been reducing, as you know, the number of residents there over the course of time, over the last 2 to 3 years. And I feel like that's been a real success. Listen, we are behind in Illinois in terms of, you know, the SODCs, our state-operated developmental centers. Most states have gotten rid of those mass congregate facilities like we have over the years. We never did in Illinois.
Newly appointed and state rep Scott Doody visited the rally, explaining to supporters what he's learned about the situation.
$50 million is in the budget to run show till July 1st of 2027, and the AFSCME union and the other unions, security and others that work at SHOT, were assured by Governor Pritzker's administration there would be a transition period at SHOT, more forensics, no jobs lost, and retraining.
Doody worries this move will leave a hole for mental health services in the region.
This is a disaster, and there's no need for it. I need the governor to please think about the plans that they're making in health and human services, and let's slow down, take a breath, and get organized about what we're going to do.
Dillman says the layoffs of 250 jobs will have an impact on Anna, Union County, and the surrounding region.
I mean, some of us are rooted here. We have kids in our local schools. We have mortgages, and we don't have the option just to pick up and move up north.
The local AFSCME unit met with their state leadership on Tuesday to discuss the IDHS decision. With WSIU News, I'm Brian Sapp.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargile.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely.
It was July 27th, 2004, when a relatively unknown 42-year-old Illinois state senator delivered the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, Massachusetts.
I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible.
4 months earlier, Barack Obama had won the Illinois Democratic primary for U.S. Senate by an unexpected landslide. He was campaigning against controversial Republican candidate Jack Ryan at the time of the convention address. Obama's DNC speech propelled him onto the national stage and defined what America meant to him.
It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too.
Barack Obama won his Senate race by another landslide. He was elected the nation's 44th president 4 years later and served 2 terms. I'm Clint Cargile, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
After Congress allowed the Affordable Care Act tax credits to lapse, health care premiums spiked for millions of self-employed Americans and part-time workers. Farmers and ranchers were among the groups hit the hardest, and they've already been dealing with a tough agricultural economy. Harvest Public Media's Macy Byers tells us how health care costs are influencing decisions on the farm.
Ben Steffen is driving past fields of corn and soybeans on his farm in southeastern Nebraska.
Crops growing fast and the weeds are growing faster.
Yeah.
We pull up to a barn that's full of hay. It used to hold dairy cattle, but Steffen sold them a few years ago. Now he's focused on crops, but costs have been high this year as the war with Iran pushed up fertilizer and diesel prices.
I mean, this is the most expensive crop we've ever put in the ground. And it's kind of breathtaking when you do this year after year and you keep seeing those numbers go up.
On top of those high input costs for farming, Steffen and his wife, Paula Sue, are also dealing with higher costs for health care. They used to be part of a group health plan when they had employees handling the dairy operation. Since then, they've switched to an Affordable Care Act plan, or Obamacare.
Last year, we paid around $13,000. Net after we got our premium credit back.
That was for the two of us. That was our out-of-pocket expense.
Yeah. And this year, we're on track to pay $32,000 a year.
$32,000. That's about $2,700 a month, more than double what they were paying the year before. And that's one of the cheapest options. ACA plans are a common choice for people who can't access health care through a traditional employer, like farmers and ranchers. Congress allowed tax credits to expire this year that covered some of the health plan's costs. Now, premiums have doubled or even tripled for many users.
It's scary because it's cutting into their bottom line. They didn't necessarily budget for this. They didn't plan for this.
That's Nick Lewandowski, who leads the Kansas Farmers Union.
And so therefore, they've got to make difficult decisions around that. You know, I have heard of people who've just flat out dropped their insurance.
Lewandowski, who also farms, says his own ACA premiums nearly tripled this year. Some lower-cost health options for farmers are offered through farm bureaus and unions, but the plans are limited. Many farm families have a spouse work off the farm to get health insurance. Dina Vanderzalm works with the Missouri Rural Crisis Center. She says the organization advocated for the Affordable Care Act because it kept family members on the farm and helped farmers address medical issues earlier.
Having access to insurance is super duper important for the farming community because that's protecting them from letting massive medical debt sink the farm, right? It's a layer of protection.
The Missouri Rural Crisis Center and other groups are calling on Congress to bring back the ACA tax credits. In the meantime, Vanderzalm says farmers are dealing with razor-thin margins.
It is a constant juggle. You know, we're still hearing from people of, like, we're making choices on bills, we're paying minimums on things, we're setting up payment plans with doctor's offices, not just hospitals.
She says farmers are used to unpredictable factors, like weather or how their harvest will turn out. But now it's a given that their health plan will be expensive. Even though the business is tough now, Ben and Paula Sue Steffen say they still wouldn't choose any other profession.
The freedom to be self-employed is undervalued and underappreciated. Our corn's growing 3 or 4 inches every day, it seems like, and you can just see the landscape changing, and it's a hopeful season. It's a hopeful business, really.
And the 64-year-olds hope this will be their last year with high health costs as they plan to enroll in Medicare next year. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Macy Byers.
Statewide continues in a moment. And welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Kimberly Sigafis believes the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence is an opportunity to tell a fuller American story, one that includes the experiences, resilience, and contributions of Native people. As part of our Illinois 250 series, in partnership with Illinois Humanities, the Minnesota-born author of 20 books reflects on reconnecting with her Native heritage as an adult after growing up away from her father's White Earth Reservation community. She says that journey not only helped her discover her own identity, but also gave her the knowledge to pass Native traditions and values onto her children. She spoke with Randy Eccles.
Tell us your story. Where'd you grow up? I understand you decided to become a writer.
I grew up in Minnesota. I'm a Minnesota girl. I currently live in Illinois, so I'm a transplant over here. I grew up in Minnesota. My family is from White Earth Reservation, which is in the northwest corner of Minnesota, about an hour east of Fargo. I grew up not on the reservation. My father died when I was a year, and my mother is not Native, and she moved us into the inner city of Minneapolis where her parents lived. I grew up knowing I was Native, but I didn't know much about it. And it wasn't until I had grown up and gotten married and started having children that I decided that I would delve into my Native side. And that's really where my education started. And that was about 40 years ago, kind of aging me, I know. I started my Native education there. I had reached out to my father's family, and that's really where it started. I'm really interested in a lot of different parts of being a Native American as well. The cultural differences between how I grew up and how I might have grown up had I been on the reservation. I actually have been writing for a very, very long time. I can't remember a day when I didn't write something, even as a child. I've been writing for a very long time. I have 20 books out now. They all have a Native American theme or they're centered in Native culture. I write in almost all genres, children's, young adult, fiction, nonfiction. I enjoy that very much, actually. I enjoy the research that comes with that, as well as being able to tell a story. I enjoy that quite a bit.
You really have had two lives to some extent. You had your life before you got to do your research and since. What triggered that and what have you learned as you've gone through this process?
I want to be able to pass on all of my background and my culture to my children. That was what really triggered me. We moved a lot when I was a child and I never felt like I fit in anywhere. The person who wasn't white, the schools didn't know where to put me as far as I wasn't African-American, and so they weren't sure how to handle some of the discrimination that was going on with me when I was growing up. Writing became a way where no matter where we moved, I could take that with me, and that was my safe place. Learning about my Native culture, as I realized, as I started learning about it, the more I realized that that's where I fit in the most. While I love my mom's culture, which is Irish Catholic and German, I realize that I'm more, my heart and soul is Native, and that is where I connect to the world. And so I've been able to pass that on to my own children. They have had a little piece of each, and they've made their decisions as well as far as which side they connect mostly to. I can tell you that all of my children have some Native aspects in their life. They organic farm or sing and drum or play the flute. I'm really glad that I delved into that, basically found myself and was able to give a really basic, great platform for my children to grow up in as well and be proud of who they are.
You are an Illinois Rhodes Scholar and you've prepared a program for Illinois Humanities called We the Native People. Can you tell us a little more about that?
I got to thinking about the 250th anniversary and I thought to myself, well, how does this connect with the Native people? Because during that time, we still weren't life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness didn't sound like us at all. And so I started looking into that. And I realized as I read the Declaration of Independence that, first of all, I had never actually read through the whole thing before. And I realized that Native people were really not thought of very well within that context. We were referred to as savage people. The King of England had actually caused us to riot and kill people. It didn't matter who they were, a child, man or woman, and it made us sound just horrible. And so I thought to myself, this sounds like a really good program for Rhodes Scholars because we are celebrating the 250th. How did that document that came out, how that affected the Native people, and did it affect the Native people? Well, no, it really didn't, except that it emphasized in other people's minds that we're savage people and that the people who were discriminating against us at that time, who thought of us as people that were stupid or people that were horrible, it gave them, they went, well, it's in the Declaration of Independence, so it must be true. It just reinforced all of that feeling. So it didn't do us any good at the time anyway. It's really stood for a kind of a dark time for us. We've actually moved up from that, persevered through that, and we have resilience from that. It's kind of in the very beginning, it's very, very matter of fact, and this is what it said in the Declaration. But I do talk about we're not stuck there in 1776. You know, we have moved on, and it's caused us to stand up for ourselves and to form our own governments and become sovereign nations, really become a part of this United States. Yes, land was taken from us. We have contributed to this United States. And for the most part, I believe that most Native American people are proud to be Americans because of that. And we have served in the military and we have supported the United States the best that we can. We have passed on our traditions to other cultures in order to help them. We've contributed a lot. The way people view us now is hopefully a lot better than back in 1776.
With the 250th of the Declaration of Independence, it's revered to some extent, but when you look at it closely and how it was a vision statement for white European men mostly at the time, it's taken a long time to get to this place where hopefully everybody's being recognized and treated with equity. But as we've seen, even with current events, that's still a challenge for this country.
Initially, we started in such a place that nobody understood us. I think there's a lot of fear when you don't understand a culture, if people start thinking things about you and they don't know for sure. And we have overcome some of that. So I am really proud and happy about that.
Just in case somebody wants to look into it more, it was the American Indian Chicago Conference in 1961, which came up with a Declaration of Indian Purpose.
I do know the AIC was, that organization coming to be in Chicago was huge for Illinois. We had very little Native people that were prior to that, that lived here. You couldn't get a job here. You couldn't find a home here. Nobody would rent to you. The discrimination was not great. It was not good for the Native people. It wasn't until the AIC opened and really started inviting people back into the Chicagoland area that we didn't have very many Native people once the Indian Removal Act had removed everybody. They were very instrumental in helping.
The Removal Act moved almost everybody west of the Mississippi out of Illinois. It's only been really recently that some of that has been recognized. There's been some land exchange, et cetera, that has happened to partially respond to what has happened. Where have you felt most proud and most conflicted about this relationship?
I feel very proud, actually, about how the Native people have persevered through all of this. I'm very happy that people's hearts have opened up more to us and are willing to give us, let us talk and have a say, and are interested in the culture now. Back in the 50s, you didn't want to admit if you were Native American at all, because you wouldn't, like I said, you couldn't get a job or a place to live. Now it seems like I do a lot of Native, I do about 60 of them, some for the Illinois Humanity Road Scholars. I have a lot of people that are very interested in the culture. And so I'm very proud about that. Proud about the way that we are sharing, that we've opened our hearts and accepted that culture, and also opened our hearts and are now able to share that culture. As being disenchanted with our country, I wish we were farther along. I wish we were not discriminating against anybody. We were all equal, and that the skin color didn't matter of anybody, where you live and how you live or who you worship or anything else, I think is preference. And I just wish that everyone would be accepted for who they are inside and not by the way they look.
I appreciate that. And in the same theme, what can be done to make this year's recognition more inclusive and honest in accounting?
You know, I think inviting all cultures, including Native people, to really come out and tell their stories. I mean, we're all very aware of how the Native people were treated, you know, way back when, and that they were removed and, you know, all of that. But I think inviting, if you have a celebration in your town, invite people out, Native elders out, or people out to talk about their culture and how the signing affected them, but how far we've come from that and how far we can go from that as well. Just inclusiveness with everybody is probably the best way to do that.
Whenever you get to talk with somebody on a regular basis, it's a lot easier to understand. We're all human and face a lot of the same challenges. Our differences make us richer. It's challenging sometimes, especially with some of the past history, like the Removal Act, to interact with each other. One of the things we talked about briefly was the Land Back movement. What do these efforts mean to you? Are they important? Are they realizing some of the promise of the Declaration of Independence?
Well, they're important. I think they are important. I understand the importance of getting your land back. Because of our history and our past, it makes sense. And it does some good for the government and the people to understand what happened and how it wasn't right to go about things the way that it happened. I don't think it fixes the entire problem. I don't think it fixes the entire past. However, I do think it's a step forward in the future for better things to come. And we don't, I don't believe, and I can't speak for every Native person, but I know for myself, I know that even though it doesn't fix everything that happened in the past, it makes me very confident and hopeful that things are going to keep going down this path. We can't get all our land back. We can't kick everybody off of their land. For example, I live on Potawatomi land, so I don't think that I should be removed from my land and have to, you know, end up going back up to Minnesota where I'm from. I think that doesn't make sense, but I think the acknowledgement of the things that were done wrong, I think acknowledging, Maya Angelou used to say, when you know better, you do better. And so I think that that's where my heart has always been at. So if you are look like you're moving forward with your thoughts and your thinking in your heart, then I think that's the right direction.
If people want to know and learn more about Native Nations in Illinois, any recommendations of where to go learn more or see or anything like that?
There are really great museums in the state of Illinois. Field Museum has a great exhibit, for example, a Native people exhibit. The Mitchell Museum is going through a transformation. I think it's called Gichigama Museum now, and that is in Evanston, and that is a really terrific museum to go to. I also suggest books by people like Joe Bruschak and Tim Tingle and Louise Erdrich, and those Native really good stories and storytelling. So I think you have to be careful if you look at stuff on the internet because you don't know who's putting it on there. As I always caution people about doing research on the internet, make sure you're at a site that you know is a good site and it's not propagandizing bad things. I've always told people is your best way of knowledge, of learning any knowledge. Reaching out, I'm going to powwows and reaching out to the Native community and joining in on things like that, I think is also another good way to do that.
Illinois Humanities, as part of Illinois 250, is also promoting Illinois Passport. It's got several different sites you can go to, including Cahokia Mounds, Blackhawk State Historic Site, Isla Alacache, and Romeoville. So there are a lot of those things you can find at il250.org. Anything you'd like to leave us with as we wrap up today, Kim?
I think just if you have the chance to experience or immerse yourself, even for a day in the Native culture, I think you should give that a chance. I think people should give that a chance. There's a lot of powwows in the summer. There's a lot of events going on in the summer. And I think that people coming out and really experiencing what it is like to be Native and eating the food and talking with the elders and listening to the flute music and watching the dancers. That's really what we're all about. We honor the earth. We honor the sky. And so we are here as stewards of our land and of the earth. And so we do have good things that we can pass on to people. And so I just encourage people to reach out and embrace the Native culture.
Kim Sigifis speaking with Randy Eccles. The Minnesota-born author joined us for our Illinois 250 series in partnership with Illinois Humanities, discussing her Native American heritage. Public health officials are still investigating how a parasite spread through human feces, called Cyclospora, ended up in the U.S. food supply. Thousands of people across the country, including in Illinois, have gotten sick from the parasite, which causes frequent diarrhea. Although the parasite is rare in the U.S., contaminated water irrigated to fields has been a culprit of past outbreaks. Kristen Gibson is director of the University of Arkansas Center for Food Safety. She says food is never 100% safe.
And I know people don't want to hear that, but we eat food all the time and we do not get sick. And these types of failures happen, and the best thing you can do is try to gather as much information as we possibly can to be sure that we either put new measures or preventive controls in place so it doesn't happen again.
Experts say to clear out recalled foods, but they stress not all produce is contaminated. Back with more on Statewide in a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The new Planned Parenthood of Illinois board chair is committed to providing access to anyone who needs it, no matter where they live in the state. Carolyn Moon took the helm as board chair for the nonprofit and is the first person to lead the board while calling McLean County home. She says she brings a fresh perspective on rural health care and understands downstate patients face unique barriers to access that residents of bigger cities may not. In an interview with the correspondent Jamie Hand, Moon says it should not be as hard as it is to receive life-saving health care.
The role of Central Illinois is kind of the role we're playing in the state as a whole, which is to serve as many people in the state as we possibly can. So one of our strategic priorities is education. We're really trying to reach out to other communities and help people connect to the educational opportunities, the curriculums, the online education that we offer.
As you know, the Planned Parenthood location in Bloomington closed in early 2025 due to financial challenges. Are there any plans to begin offering services in Bloomington again soon?
Well, we continue to offer services virtually to Bloomington and the whole area and statewide. So we made a decision to invest into telehealth and almost all of the services that we offered at the health center are still available virtually.
And have you seen adoption of that telehealth technology increase since the center closed?
We have. We also increased the capacity at the other Central Illinois health centers, so Peoria, Champaign, Springfield.
What other kinds of pressures is Planned Parenthood of Illinois facing? How do you plan to work through those?
You probably know that Planned Parenthood was defunded according to the Big Beautiful Bill. So we were kind of shut out from receiving federal funds for anything. We've recently been reinstated, but that was such a challenge for the last over a year. Fortunately, we live in Illinois that really values sexual and reproductive freedom. So they filled in some of the gaps for us, but just as a, you know, as you probably already know, federal funds never went to pay for abortion and never have. However, the federal government just specifically targeted Planned Parenthood by name and defunded them, shut them out of the program.
Why do you think that is?
I think that they understand the support that we have. I think it's misogyny. I think it's anti-trans kind of talking points that the current administration has right now. We provide a lot of gender-affirming hormone therapy, and we're very proud of that. We also provide abortions, medical and other, that we're also very proud of. We provide health care that people need, life-saving health care that people need. So we hope that healthcare decisions will not be politicized moving forward, but we're ready for that if it is.
How has the Supreme Court's 2022 Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, changed the landscape of providing reproductive health care in Central Illinois?
We've received a lot of out-of-state patients seeking abortions, and we've provided life-saving care. I was a volunteer at the Springfield Health Center, and I talked to a man in the parking lot who had brought his wife from Missouri. Their fetus was in distress and was not going to survive, but she personally was getting so sick and so ill, and her doctor in Missouri could not provide an abortion for her, even though she was in medical danger. He brought her in the car, drove her to the Springfield Health Center, and got her the life-saving abortion that she needed. You know, it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that hard.
What are some misconceptions that Illinois residents may have about Planned Parenthood?
I think the two biggest misrepresentations or misunderstandings is that, one, we're just an abortion provider. We are a comprehensive sexual and reproductive health provider. And I think the second one is that we only serve, Medicaid patients, which is not true. We are a high-quality, premier healthcare organization. We provide services to everybody who needs us, including people who are self-pay, including people who are on private insurance. We really pride ourselves in being the best healthcare provider that we can be.
Can you talk about how you will kind of steer the ship of the board differently from how it's been done in the past? What kind of unique lens or perspective you'll bring?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the unique lens I bring to it is that downstate perspective. I really am an advocate for access for everyone in the state, corner to corner, today, tomorrow, and for future generations.
And what led you to this line of work?
My mother told me long ago, if women do not have control of their reproductive systems when they have children, they cannot have control of anything else in their life. That is a primary need that women face in order to have, freedom.
Planned Parenthood of Illinois Board Chair Carolyn Moon says many people don't realize the breadth of services Planned Parenthood provides. 10% of Illinois Planned Parenthood patients are men. Clinics provide comprehensive sexual and reproductive health services for any gender. This includes cancer screenings, UTI testing, birth control, and gender-affirming hormone therapy. Eric Sorensen is the only meteorologist serving in Congress. The former TV weatherman is looking to use his training to help shape federal policy to keep Americans safe from weather disasters. Eric Stock reports.
For about two decades, Eric Sorensen advised his TV viewers when to get to the basement, when a tornado was coming, or when to get off the icy roads.
My job today is very much, I don't want to say it's the same. My job is so similar to what happened before, because people could trust me for helping them make good decisions.
Sorensen is a Democrat from Moline who was in his second term in Washington. He represents portions of Bloomington Normal, Peoria, and much of central and northwestern Illinois. Sorensen says he'd like to see the federal government take a more proactive role in more accurately forecasting the weather and warning the public when precautions are necessary. Sorensen says when the federal government is usually associated with weather disasters, it's after the fact, such as the floods in Texas in July of last year, when more than 100 people, many of them children, were killed.
You know, when we saw all of those young people just get wiped away, we didn't get to know those children. But also, the first thing that happened after that disaster that really bugged me was the fact that people lost their life, and now we're not going to do anything about it.
Sorensen found a Republican colleague, Congressman Mike Flood of Nebraska, another former broadcaster, to help form the Weather Enterprise Caucus. It's a group of lawmakers who will assess weather forecasting and research and examine the weather's impact on the economy, national security, and our general safety. Sorensen says a more proactive federal government is necessary as the number of meteorologists decreases during a time of media consolidation and more people rely mostly on weather apps to keep them safe.
The thing that thing can't do is explain how the weather works. And so my job was to explain why things happened a certain way, to educate people so that they understood enough about the weather.
Sorensen says he also worries about the future of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, for the Trump administration's cuts to the National Weather Service. For example, Sorensen says when Elon Musk's DOGE budget-cutting enterprise fired National Weather Service electricians, it turned hours-long Doppler radar outages into weeks-long outages.
We were losing the ability to see tornadoes because the equipment was failing. If we don't have the funding appropriated from Congress, then we're not going to have weather balloons that are going up to give us that three-dimensional look at what's going on in the weather.
Sorensen says he wants to see the U.S. Weather Enterprise get better at assessing risk. He says that will require better technology. The National Weather Service is in the midst of upgrading its old Doppler radar systems, which date back to the 1980s. He says better information going in will help Congress make better assessments of how money can be spent to build resiliency when it comes to floods, tornadoes, and other disasters.
Are we making sure, from a policy perspective, that we're designing roadways that are going to withstand these floods? So it's not just education. Are we making sure that the policy is there? Are we driving home the federal tax dollars to rebuild infrastructure to keep people safe?
Sorensen has proposed three weather-related proposals during this term in Congress. One was to reverse staff cuts at the National Weather Service. Another would have studied how to improve weather forecasting in rural America in light of the federal cuts to NOAA. Most recently, Sorensen proposed a bill to set up an independent review board to investigate major weather-related disasters. None has gotten a hearing so far. Sorensen says weather is not a partisan issue.
When you look at where most of the severe weather occurs in this nation, that's red states. That's why I don't want to say it's easier to make this bipartisan. That's why it was bipartisan from the start.
Sorensen says if the Weather Caucus can save one life, it'll be worth it. I'm Eric Stock.
The Odyssey has had the biggest box office opening of any live-action film this year. And among those in the audience, many high school teachers. This ancient story of Odysseus and his 20-year journey back home is often loved by teachers, hated by students. As Sequoia Carrillo reports, this film may change that.
Casey Crowhurst has taught high school English for the past 16 years, and one text has always been a bit of a challenge.
The Odyssey was always one we kind of struggled with.
Getting his students at Monticello High School in Eastern Illinois to pay attention was a tall order.
Because you tell them, hey, this was written 2,000 plus years ago, and right away they're going to be like, well, why do I have to learn this?
He's used clips from the 1997 Hallmark miniseries to help keep them engaged. In this scene, the Greek god Hermes floats around Odysseus as he hangs off the side of a cliff.
Here, eat this. Oh, the smoothie. It's poison. I'm giving it to you. A god to a mortal.
Crowhurst says his students find the dated special effects from the miniseries silly. So after he saw The Odyssey, he posted his gratitude for the film's director on TikTok.
I just saw The Odyssey, and I want to say on behalf of all English teachers, thank you, Christopher Nolan. Thank you.
There are countless adaptations of Homer's epic poem, from The Simpsons to The Stage to other movies with big-name actors like George Clooney and now Matt Damon in the role of Odysseus, with Anne Hathaway as Penelope.
Promise me you will come back.
What if I can't?
The new film stood out to Crowhurst for emphasizing something other versions haven't.
No one's ever really taken The Odyssey from that perspective of what he calls Zeus's Law.
Zeus's Law, or treating all people with hospitality and as equals, is a big theme of the movie.
That point was made so perfectly in the film, and I was just in awe.
So I'm so excited that this movie is coming out, because I love including any kind of outside media in my classroom that I can, because it's excited to learn.
Erin Hall teaches English at Albemarle High School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Some of her students are already excited to learn about the Odyssey. Maybe they've read books like Percy Jackson and the Olympians that cover Greek mythology, but others take a little convincing.
So I use a bunch of stuff. I use cheesy movies. I use, you know, Epic the Musical. We look at paintings. So I am excited to have another thing in the toolbox to use.
Sarah Knoll teaches the Odyssey to a different group of students at South Lakes High School in Reston, Virginia, multilingual learners. This past year, most of her students were from Central America and Afghanistan, along with...
I had a student from Pakistan, from China, from India. We have a fair number of Sudanese students, so it's definitely a linguistically diverse group.
She says the epic is perfect for showing the foundations of storytelling. They don't study the original text. Instead, she shows clips of the miniseries and other adaptations and stretches it out over a few months.
They create a kind of dictionary of the important vocabulary that they need.
Things like ship, sea, king, suitor. She says the unit is one of her students' favorites.
Ultimately, it's the story of Odysseus having to leave his home, his family, and head out into the world, not knowing if he'll ever come home. And it's a very powerful story.
And for her students, many of them immigrants, it's something they see themselves in.
Sequoia Carrillo with that report. That will do it for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being with us. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.